Welcome to another UCTV.tv podcast presented by University of California Television.
Welcome to A Conversation with History. I'm Harry Kreisler of the Institute of International Studies. Our guest today is Abdullah An-Naim, who is the Charles Howard Candler Professor of Law at Emory University. He is renowned for his scholarship on human rights in Islam and on human rights in cross-cultural settings. His most recent book is Islam and the Secular State: Negotiating the Future of Sharia. He is on the Berkeley campus this semester as the 2010 Tanner Professor. Professor, welcome to Berkeley.
Thank you.
Where were you born and raised?
I was born in a village north of Khartoum, Sudan, on the Nile in 1946, and I was raised in the village and then followed my father around various towns in northern Sudan going to school, and then the University of Khartoum, graduated in 1970.
And looking back, how do you think your parents shaped your thinking about the world?
I think my mother did more, but my father also was, both of them were very committed to education, but also they were very open in their lifestyle, in their minds. It's remarkable, my mother never learned to read and write, but she's one of the most educated people I have known in my life. And my father also struggled with a self-educated man. So I grew up valuing education, but also valuing the need to be open to life and possibilities and to other people. I think that is how they raised us.
And we're speaking of your mother, was she a product of an oral tradition that made her educated, although not, you know, with degrees, so to speak?
Yes, oral tradition, but also extremely smart. I mean, she was a very intelligent woman. She just grew up in a Sudan where women and girls were not really allowed to go to school much. But now her daughters, she puts us all through education and higher education, and her daughters also now are all educated. And I think for me it is remarkable to see in one generation how the possibilities that were never open to my mom are now available to my sisters and my children.
Mm-hmm. And what, because your education was into the ways of modernity, you have PhDs and law degrees in legal and philosophical studies. What helps us understand their push for you to be educated in a way that went beyond the traditional education?
I think they helped me and my siblings to be open and to be willing to engage new ideas and to be critical in our thinking. I think their greatest gift to me personally is really to make me able to take advantage of the possibilities that I came to have. And then I have to credit my other teacher, my other father, my moral father, Ustad Mahmoud Muhammad Taha, whom I got to know while I was at the University of Khartoum as a student. And he also opened tremendous possibilities. I think so, I was fortunate. And now I look back at my sort of contemporaries in the village, throughout education in Sudan, and I wonder where they are and what they are thinking. But I'm fortunate to be where I am because of that gift I had.
Mm-hmm. And what was? We'll talk about your mentor in a moment. But I am very curious as to what are the elements that made you comfortable in pursuing, you know, an education in the ladder of modernity, so to speak. I mean, why did you choose to become a lawyer?
Of course, I mean, actually, as far as I remember as a child, that's always what I wanted to be. I never wanted to be a doctor or an engineer. To me, it was about justice and being young and thinking that you can bring justice to people's lives through law. So a belief of the fusion of law and justice goes to my very early childhood, and also to the tradition I grew up in, where learning and learning the law is a means to achieve justice. Mm-hmm. One of the gifts of my parents' insights is about substance in things, not the form. So they were religious, and they raised us to be religious, but to them, being religious is about the values of being religious, not the conformity with external piety and ostentatious piety. So I think that carried through with me about law, about ideas, as I came to always look for what's the point here, not what the form is.
And is this a gift of being a Muslim and the religious thinking about issues in the tradition of Islam?
It is that, but also it's about responsibility. I think, again, one of the aspects of the gift is to be a Muslim or to be a Christian or a Jew or any religious affiliation can be a blessing or a curse. For me, my religion is what I make of it. So I'm not saved because I'm a Muslim. It is what sort of Muslim I am and what that means in my life that makes a difference. So I think it is the ability to work with the value of religion without getting sort of too bogged down into the ritualistic formality of it.
And in your writings, which we'll talk about in a minute, I have the sense that part of your self-realization involving elements in your faith that point in the direction of self-development, even though they may be obscured because of certain traditions that developed in that religion.
Yes, I think all religions start that way. I think in our personal life stories or in the life of the tradition at large, religions start about self-realization, about self-liberation, about responsibility, about rejection of dogma. Mm-hmm. But as they get attached to power and as it becomes institutionalized, then I think the essence of the religion is lost. That's why we need to renew religious traditions now and again, because they get sort of too entangled in threads of power relations and privilege and so on. So I think that the ability to discover what the religion was about to begin with, to me the tradition is not, it cannot be stagnant. It has to be about dynamism and self-renewal, the tradition itself, or else it ceases to be a tradition. It becomes a dead tradition. If it's a living tradition, then the essence of following the tradition is to follow the innovative, the creative, the sort of what I call every religion needs its heretics. For me, heresy is critical to the viability of religious experience and the authenticity of religious experience. So to keep the door open for heretics is really a blessing for every religion.
And was this an insight that you learned from your parents, that is, the way they saw the world?
They wouldn't have articulated it in those so many words, but the way they saw the world was a way on which you seek the substance and you don't get sort of enslaved to the formality of it. And therefore, you are always questioning whether this is the right thing to do, not whether it is the right thing that other people think, but what you think and what you are responsible for and so on.
And let me understand, as you your education ends up in legal studies, but in your earlier education, what were pieces of wisdom, books, subjects that you pursued that provided steps toward your ultimate insights?
To me, I think in the Muslim tradition, the Sufi tradition is the best. I mean, it is the most humane. I call it the humane face of Islam. It is the most profound. So being exposed to Sufi poetry, Sufi insights, that's where because they are really about what the essence of spirituality is rather than the formality of religious dogma is. So I think for me, the Sufi tradition in the Muslim experience is very foundational. But also I got exposed to Western philosophy. I remember as a student in high, sort of what we call then intermediate school, which is like high school level. I love to argue, and I remember my teacher calling me Socrates. I mean, like he was sort of joking that because I always, especially in the religious instruction class, I was questioning and pushing, and so he called me that in disapproval, like you are argumentative, you are. But I really. Then I went to look and see what is this man, why am I called this, and so that was, I think, all of that came together for me. And one thing that I came to understand is that as a human being, I should remain open to all human experience, and I should benefit from all human experience, good and bad.
A formative influence, as you mentioned, was Muhammad Taha. Mm-hmm. Tell us a little about who he was and your first encounter, if not with him, then what he was offering in the way of a path.
Ustad Mahmoud Muhammad Taha was actually a civil engineer by training and by profession, but he was a Sufi in orientation, and he himself embodied very much the values I have been talking about in terms of how he transformed himself and realized fundamental insights about what it means to be human and to be Muslim and to submit to the will of God and to live by that. So I had heard about him long before I met him the first time. And I remember as a young man growing up, we were told, beware, don't listen to him because he's a spellbinder. He will catch you and you will never escape. But by chance, I happened to attend one of his lectures when I was still at the University of Khartoum, a student in my second to third year.
You would have been about how old?
About 18, 19, I think, yes. And I could never walk away. I mean, I just heard that first lecture. It was about the Islamic constitution, yes and no. So his argument was that we need the constitution to be about the substance of being Muslim, but never to be called an Islamic constitution. And again, or an Islamic state, as I came to argue in this book. So I listened, I felt not only that he was talking to me, but he was talking for me. That everything he said sounded to me like something that I would have thought or felt and wanted to say. So I could never walk away. So I started following him around and going to his other lectures. He was an engineer, but also conducting sort of this personal mission of propagating a very ingenious, I think, reformulation and reinterpretation of Sharia. So I followed him, and it was a struggle because he was seen to be a heretic, to be an outsider. And to me, he was the best Muslim that can ever be. So I couldn't understand that. So I was lucky enough to stick around long enough to become one of his students and to follow him and to be part of his movement.
And what he was offering for a young person such as yourself is a path between what was modern and what was secular in a way, but at the same time, trying to grapple with its relation to the tradition and not rejecting the tradition. Is that
yes,
right?
Yes. Yeah. I think he helped me come to peace with myself. I think that, like when I heard him and I read his work, I felt like being washed in a sense of inner tranquility and peace, because as a young man growing up, I was committed to values of human rights, of constitutional governance, of democratic governance. But the tradition of which I was part as a Muslim growing up in Sudan was antithetical to all of that. And I couldn't understand how Islam could be so negative about women, about religious minorities, freedom of religion, by showing me that What I rejected in Islam was not really the essence of Islam, but it was a human interpretation that was contextually, historically conditioned. And so his basic message was that we can only understand and experience being religious through our experience in life, through our context, our history, and that we couldn't possibly repeat or reenact earlier understandings of Islam, which Muslims accept as Sharia, in the modern context, because that is not what the message of Islam is for us today. So I think in that sense, yes, he brought me to, he gave me sort of an inner sense of sort of reconciliation, two parts of myself, the longing for the authenticity and depth and emotional attachment of tradition, and the commitment to contemporary values of human rights and democratization and so on.
And you actually translated his scholarship once you came to the West and so on. I'm curious, because you were a follower and he was a charismatic leader with substance. How do you account for his insights? Was it because he was a learned man, because he was an engineer, because he was a religious man, all of the above? I mean, what led him to this path that helped you understand your path?
I think very much the very fact that, as I have come to know in my own life, that or any of those gifts can be an impediment. I mean, that the question is, being religious or being an engineer or being a professional man, being an educated man, all of that could become a barrier rather than a bridge to insight. But I think that his anchor, and the anchor that I hope he had passed on to me and other of his students, is that true spirituality is not about power. It's about renouncing power. And that is where you gain a more sustainable and a more sort of self-renewing power, when you renounce it, not when you invest in it. So his lifestyle, for me, what was most striking about his ability to live what he preached. And to me, that remains the test for myself and anybody else. So to what extent do our actions reflect the values we proclaim? If they don't, then there is no value in the values we proclaim. So it is the living flesh and blood of being pious, not of appearing to be pious or putting on the semblance of pious and so on.
In your lecture, you emphasize the importance of changing yourself so you can change the world, following on the examples of Gandhi and Martin Luther King and others that you talked about. And I have the sense now, as I listen to you, that important in this struggle is not an out-and-out rejection of any of the traditions that you're grappling with, whether it's modernity or in tradition. So part of this self-development is doing the hard work of navigating between them, as opposed to rejecting that one or another or embracing one or another totally. Is that fair?
Yes, I think that's true. To me, I call it mediation, because it is not a categorical resolution. When I'm not rejecting religion, I'm not rejecting modernity, I'm not accepting the perceived truth of religion and or modernity on face value. So to mediate is to sort of travel between the two and to bring a synthesis within my own self, my own consciousness and experience and commitment and practice. By that synthesis. And I think each of us have to find her own or his own sort of synthesis of tradition and modernity, of whatever competing paradigms that we live around by. And I think people like Gandhi and Martin Luther King have really done tremendously in transforming the nature of power. Power is part of life, and power struggles are part of... we shouldn't be naive to think we can have a powerless or a conflict-free experience. But the question is transform the terms of the conflict to make it non-violent, but the notion of force, not violence. That they are not naive, they were not naive, they sought to affirm, but to transform the nature of power. These ideas, I find them in my own personal life day by day. And for me, I'm not responsible for outcomes. I'm responsible for what I do and say. So to the extent that I live what I preach to the best of my ability and do my best to transform my environment, social as well as material, then I have done my part. I'm not responsible for the outcome.
What happened to your mentor? Did he enter politics? And then what were the consequences?
He was never in politics in the sense of seeking power. He started in the 1930s when the Sudanese sort of independence struggle started, establishing a political party called the Republican Party, because he was seeking to establish a republic in Sudan, a democratic republic in Sudan. But when in the 1960s, the party was never going to contest elections. It was a vehicle for promoting ideas about Islamic reform. And in the 1960s, when political parties were banned, he transformed it into its just simply a social movement or a religious, intellectual, reformation movement. And it continued to work for from the 50s into the 80s. But he was political, but not a politician. So he engaged political issues of the day. He had an opinion, a position on every single issue that came along. Eventually, of course, and he was tolerated by various types of so-called civilian and military regimes in Sudan, until eventually it came to head in the early 80s, 1980s, when Numeri, who was the dictator of the time, he was started as a military dictator and turned Sudan into a single-party state, suddenly shifted to Islamic fundamentalist ideology and decided to impose Sharia as a state law. And Taha came out openly against that, charging it as a distortion of Islam and the destruction of the unity of the country. For that single sheet of paper, manifesto or statement, he was put on trial for political crimes of treason, undermining the constitution. Nothing that really he did was anything of that. And he was convicted and sentenced to death, and he was executed in January 1985. And I left Sudan in April, about 3 months after he was executed.
And then you came, then you actually, what was your next path? In other words, you left your country with a commitment to advocacy, so you wanted to work at implementing this heritage that you had?
Yes, I thought it was my personal charge. I was fortunate because I had an American friend who was a professor at UCLA Law School who invited me to come and to teach at UCLA for 2 years. And at that time, I finished the translation of The Second Message of Islam, Ustaz Mahmoud's main book. Had it published by Syracuse in 1987. And so I felt that, and by the way, the way Ustaz Mahmoud himself, in the early 80s, before I left Sudan, one day he just handed me that book and he said, translate this. And of course, because of my training, I had English and Arabic, and so I took it as a personal charge to do that. But then for me, it became, once he was executed and the movement was suppressed in Sudan, I had to leave, but thinking that my mission is to bring his ideas to the world. That to make it that you cannot kill an idea by killing its author. So that was my mission. And I kept watching to see things changing in Sudan so I could go back. And for several years, I took short-term appointments in various places until the early 90s, when it looks like it was not likely to be that I can go back home soon. I took a position as the director of Africa Watch based in Washington, D.C.
So this was Human Rights Watch?
Yes, it was a division of Human Rights Watch. It's called Africa Watch at the time, and then became a division of Human Rights Watch as a united organization. And then in 1995, I went to Emory to go back to teaching in law school. So I've been teaching at Emory Law School since 95.
Help us understand the skill set that is necessary, because you're navigating this world between tradition and modernity, but you're also becoming a lawyer, and you are both a lawyer and a legal philosopher, and a philosopher about politics and Islam. What if students were watching this? What are the elements in managing all of these portfolios? It sounds like there's both an intellectual dimension, a professional dimension, but also a psychological dimension.
I hope there's all that, but what I know is that it's a personal quest. I'm not really in this for achieving any of those distinctions or claims to expertise. I'm just personally seeking what I believe to be right and to do what I think is the right thing to do. And I'm blessed and I'm really privileged to be an American citizen at this point, where I can pursue this with vigor and with vitality and to be able to reach. You know, it is amazing that having published Ustaz Mahmoud's book in English and my own first book in 1990, which is called Toward an Islamic Reformation, in which I applied his ideas, those ideas were read more in English than they could ever be read in Arabic. So although he wrote in Arabic, and my own native language is Arabic, but English is spoken by more Muslims around the world than Arabic is. And publishing in English, you reach more young people and students and professionals than you reach them in writing Arabic, which is restricted also in the Arab region for censorship reasons. Taha's books are not available in the Arab world for public, even in Sudan, they are still banned. But to being able to translate, I could reach Muslims in Indonesia, Muslims in Central Asia, in sub-Saharan Africa. And so that is what I see is I'm just pursuing a way of fulfilling what I believe is my personal charge, for which I'm personally responsible. Everything else is really truly incidental to that.
And in this mission, there is an important element of both education and advocacy. That is, you to paraphrase what you just said, you're trying to in changing yourself, you want a byproduct of that to be in a position to help change the world. Is that fair?
Yes, I think it's fair, but also to realize that the most we can do is to do the best we can. As I said, I'm not responsible for outcomes, but I am responsible for trying to improve my way of doing what I do, to make it as persuasive and as accessible as I can make it. On my homepage, I have this notion, I call it, I think we have a website about Islam and human rights, and we call it a scholarship for social change. That is really the motto I work with, which is, it has to be scholarship for it to be useful. So bad scholarship doesn't help any cause. But for me, a scholar should not be neutral in the sense of being non-committal about taking moral positions and political positions. I should invest in investigating issues in vigorous scholarship, but ultimately I have to take a position and I have to defend that position until I'm persuaded to change it. So for me, it is that pursuit of, yes, I do believe in human agency, and I do believe that all that is good and bad happens through the agency of human beings. To me, God does not act in the world except through human agency. It is the agency of human beings. That is where our moral responsibility is.
A critic of your work might say, let me be the devil's advocate here, that you are naive in your work about power and about interest groups. If we look at the case of your mentor, in other words, the end result was power said no, and took his life. So help me understand the lever by which you move beyond just rejecting power and make your ideas influential. This obviously is a perennial problem, namely theory and practice.
Sure.
And so as we develop the best ideas, and you are really doing an important contribution in that regard, in the end, what is involved in implementation?
Mm-hmm. I call myself a pragmatic optimist. So I'm optimistic in that looking at the longer span of history, and I see how great ideas came to evolve and triumph over time. I'm confident that human rights, democratization, Islamic reform will triumph over time. It is the short term that people have a hard time with. And for me, that conviction of optimism is really what is driving me. But it is a pragmatic optimism. It is not a naive optimism. It's understanding the nature of power, but seeking to co-opt it. And as I said about Gandhi, seeking to transform it. So it is not a power-free world, but it is who has power to what ends. And for me, diffusion of power and education is key to diffusion of the power of knowledge. Religious education and religious experience is the diffusion of religious authority. And so to me, I say that power and authority is in the eyes of the beholder. You have power over me to the extent that I concede it to you. But if I deny it, there is no way that you can get it. And so enhancing people's ability to hold on to their own self-empowerment and to refuse to concede power to others, whether clerics or intellectual elites of whoever, that this is my most cherished resource, my self-empowerment. I refuse to concede it. End of story. But it's not that easy, yes. And therefore, I work with political action. I work with human rights advocacy. I work with ideas to create conditions where ordinary people like myself don't have to be exceptional like Gandhi or Martin Luther King. So I'm not a hero. I don't want to be put in prison or tortured. That's why I invest in human rights. And honestly, I would say that I am more pragmatic than those who think that they can impose sort of so-called the notion of imperialism. Those who think they can impose their values on others, they are the naive ones. I am the pragmatic one who knows that it cannot be done.
Let's talk a little about Islam and the secular state and show your book and some very important ideas here, because what you are trying to do is bring a perspective to Islam and its dilemmas that it's not that you're coming up with something new. You're trying to articulate a different tradition within the tradition in order to help Muslims deal with this dilemma of modernity versus tradition. And so you have an important point about the separation of the state and Islam. Explain that to us, because you believe your faith is important in the context of a separation, but not a separation of Islam from politics.
Yes.
Please disentangle that for us.
If I may, actually, I would like to,
yes,
to read
please.
The first sentence in the first chapter, because that is really key to my whole approach. In chapter 1, the first sentence, I say, in order to be a Muslim by conviction and free choice, which is the only way one can be a Muslim, I need a secular state. So my claim is that a state that is neutral regarding religious doctrine, it does not take a position on religion, is absolutely essential for the possibility of being religious. Because once a state takes a doctrinal position of in any religion, no matter how popular and widely held that position is, it is bound to be oppressive of some believers or others who do not agree with that. So I am opposed to totalitarian states, whether ideological or religious. The second point is that what I am articulating, I think, and I try to demonstrate in chapter 2, is in fact Muslim history. That the notion of an Islamic state is the heresy. It is the new idea. It is a post-colonial discourse. That throughout 1400 years of Muslim history, the state has never been Islamic. It is in the post-colonial context, using a European idea of the state and a European idea of positive law, that Islamists like Qutb and Maududi, for the first time in the mid-20th century, articulated the notion of an Islamic state to enforce Sharia as a state law. So I am more with the tradition in naming what we have lived with as secular states, not religious states. And they, I mean the Islamists, are the ones who are departing from tradition by injecting, mixing a European idea of the state and as a hierarchical, centralized political power with a notion of positive law. To bring Sharia into enactment as a state law is a negation of the religious quality of Sharia. It ceases to be Sharia by the very act of enacting it as a state law. But then also I have to acknowledge that Muslims have this longing for their values to be reflected in their politics. And by all means, all societies do so. The point for me is that the state as an institution must be separated from religion. But politics is how people behave and the choices they make. So long as we can change our mind about the politics we choose. So I emphasize constitutionalism, human rights, and citizenship as the bulwark for what I call civic reason, which is similar to Raoul's notion of public reason, but different. My notion is more inclusive than his, and I think I find it more broadly acceptable to Muslims, because I'm saying you can justify state policies with reference to reasons that all citizens can share without or debate, without reference to religious belief. Because if you say we have to do this because God said so, end of conversation. But if you say I have to do this, we should do this democratically because of 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, I can argue with you about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. So that combination of saying that In your politics, you can reflect your religious values, but it has to be contested under constitutional protection for everybody. But institutionally, keep the state out of religion and keep religion out of the state.
Let's go over this briefly, because I want our audience to be clear about what you're saying. So in a way, the state is about power. Yeah. And about forcing people, coercing people to do things, but it performs a function, which is to create a society that is regulated. So different religions and different conversations and dialogues can occur, and in that world of society and politics, Islam, a person can be religious and bring their faith and their moral convictions to the discussion. But these two things in our time have been conflated, namely the notion that to bring Islam to politics and society, you have to control the state.
Yes.
And you are rejecting that.
Yes.
Now, what I'm curious about is that has happened in our time because of power. Mm-hmm. You know, the power of imperialism has brought changes to the Muslim world, especially the Arab world, that has been rejected by extremists within Islam. So I guess what I find intriguing is there's a power game here, both, you know, coming from the West in the form of imperialism and the reaction, you know, among Islamic extremists. And so how does one win the dialogue? How does one empower ideas such as yours and Taba to have a voice in this struggle?
I think it is already happening, but it is just to be careful and about how to do it and how to do it more effectively. The Islamists, I call them the fundamentalists, really they are disingenuous in that the rhetoric is opposing the Western imperial recent history and neocolonial history, but their practice is in fact co-opted and more taken by Western institutions. I mean, they do not reject everything Western. They are very selective. They keep the state, which is a Western institution. So in the Muslim world, in Africa, in Asia, the state was imperial. It had very little to do. So in the pre-colonial time, there were states, but they were not centralized institutional sort of bureaucracies like the European state has come to be. So when the European colonial administration, British and French, and brought this European idea of the state, and European colonialism ended, Muslim societies kept the European idea of the state as a territorially bound, centralized, hierarchical, coercive political authority. So they kept that the most characteristically European and colonial of all political institutions they kept. But they want to inject into it, so they kept the shell of a state, and they want to bring the values and the institutions of a previous era into that new shell, with which, I mean, there is incompatibility here. So that is what I'm challenging. I'm challenging that to say that since we have to live with the post-colonial state as at least the most viable for the time being until we change it through its own institutions over time, if we decide to do that. But since we have to live with it, we have to bring in the safeguards that are more consistent with the nature of the state. So constitutional governance, human rights protection, are in the experiences of the same societies that evolved these states, have been found to be extremely useful. So to go back to your remarks, I agree completely. I should have clarified. The state has limited but very important functions. But it is by far from being the totality of the public life of societies. So the state should be kept neutral for the purposes of keeping the peace, of adjudicating disputes, of allocating resources and mediating political conflicts. That is what the state is for, defending the realm against aggression. That is the functions of the state. But the rest of life, in civil society, in religious institutions, in the universities, all of that, culture, all of that is where religion can be part of life, as it should be, I believe, as a Muslim, but not to be in any way sort of co-opted by the state or co-opting the state.
You make a important distinction in trying to reinforce intellectually this separation, that the authority in religion and in the state are very different, as is the function of religious authority and political authority in the state. Talk a little about that, because it's very important. They are two different kinds of authority. And when religious leaders take over the state, which you are saying they shouldn't do, then there is a corruption of both kinds of authority.
Yes. Actually, Iran today is a very instructive example of that confusion. Because the nature of religious authority must be spontaneous in the community. That is, because it is premised on a notion of piety and religious knowledge that is very difficult to quantify or to verify. So whom I trust to be my religious and spiritual leader is someone that has to be my choice, based on my understanding of or knowledge of the person and her or his piety and honesty and consistency and so on. That sort of authority is drastically different from the nature of political authority, which is inherently coercive and which has to be something that is the object of a verifiable authority, the ability of someone to exercise authority in a coercive fashion. So confusing the two. So what I'm saying is that the nature of religious authority and the nature of political authority are fundamentally different. So someone may have the charisma and that person may enjoy a level of this and the other, but still they are different, they are separate. And this is not to say that there is no politics in religious institutions. The Catholic Church or local community of Muslims or a Jewish community, there is politics everywhere. But it is the question is that the nature of religious authority must be kept spontaneous, sort of voluntary, because to coerce someone to accept someone else's authority is a negation of the possibility of being religious. So Iran today gives us a very clear example of how, you know, when you think of the supreme ruler or guardian who is above the constitution, but how does he get to be there other than in politics? So the very idea of a council of clerics who politically get to be at the sort of the peak of religious authority is a negation of the nature of true religious piety.
In your work, you identify traditions within Islam that pose a problem for someone who's Western and modern. The treatment of women, for example, the relationship of Muslims to non-Muslims and other religious groups, those, and then the whole question of jihad, whether one implements a jihad against the other. Obviously, these three problematic areas will arise in a realm of politics. Mm-hmm. What is the key here? Because you say also that the focus of your life's work is really to mediate universalism in particular settings. So particular settings, cultures have to be respected. But what the agenda is to bring citizenship, human rights, constitutionalism to these settings. And in the politics and society, you're going to run up against these problematic areas, the treatment of women. Talk a little about that. What is the way out there?
If I can put it this way, to me, the notion of universal human rights is a concept and a content and a context. So the concept is a concept of rights of humans as humans everywhere. The content, that is, what are the specific rights, sort of the sort of list of rights that we acknowledge as human rights, is a content that is produced through a consultative, consensus-building process. So for me, the universality of the content of any, say, free equality for women, to me, it is a human right, but it is not a human right because Western societies say so, but because I believe Islam says so too. And my charge is to articulate that Islamic rationale, not only for myself, but also for other Muslims who are more likely to be persuaded if they see it as an Islamic value than if it is presented to them as a Western value that I had to concede. So it is. I say that universality is not proclaimed. It is constructed through dialogue. And I use Raoul's idea of overlapping consensus to say that we can agree on a set of human rights norms despite our disagreement as to why we come to that conviction. So as a Muslim, I choose to come to it from an Islamic discourse. not denying anybody else the right to come through that conviction through any other discourse, but claiming my right to do so in my discourse. Because as a matter of principle, that is a fulfillment of my self-determination as a person, as a community. But also, tactically, it is more likely to be persuaded to Muslim. So the values that you mentioned are the problematic aspects, which is about freedom of religion, treatment of religious minorities, women, equality for women. To me, these are human values, not Western values. And I do not accept that all Western societies subscribe to these values. After all, the Holocaust is a Western phenomenon. Fascism is a Western phenomenon. So it is not as if the West is enlightened, democratic, humane, and the rest of the world is, which was really the logic of imperialism, to say that we are out to the so-called white man's burden to civilize Africans by colonizing them. That is the same logic. So I reject that. I do not believe that human rights can be advanced by discourse that says they are Western, and my charge is to make them acceptable to Muslims. My charge is to bring Muslim voices, my own and others, into debating what human rights as a content mean. And yes, the context eventually will come in to say, even if we subscribe to these values, the way we translate how they apply in practice will also be a matter of context and priorities. And Americans should understand this because they refuse to accept international supervision of their human rights practice at home. They say our constitution is our ultimate sort of arbiter of what rights are due to Americans. And by the same token, other people will have the same claim. I think that many other societies are willing to be part of a global venture of human rights universal standards than Americans are. So come back to say, the United States is more relativist, just like China is relativist, just like Iran is relativist, more than many of the African and other Asian countries where Muslims are the majority.
So the agenda then for scholarship and your scholarship is to bring clarity and lucidity both to what human rights are on the one hand and what Islam is for Muslims. And so it's a dual education process which must be brought to bear not only for Muslim communities, but also to the powerful, such as the United States, who basically say, well, we're for universal rights. We just don't abide by them when we chose not to. And you're saying the role of advocacy is to be lucid in for both settings,
yes.
Basically.
Yeah. Yes, I think you're right. What I say is this, that the process of building consensus around human rights norms and their institutions is dual. It is what I call internal discourse to transform cultural understandings and religious understanding within Muslim communities. That is an internal discourse. Then I call cross-cultural dialogue. But my approach is premised on the ability and willingness of other human rights advocates in other societies to do their internal discourse. So that if you see, for example, the United States, and let's compare it to another country rather than a religion, world religion, Islam, say take the United States and Egypt, or United States and Turkey. American human rights advocates should be grappling with human rights issues that are problematic to Americans, not to others. And equality for women is still a problem for many Americans. The question of the death penalty, maybe the question of whatever the issue, economic and social rights, a right to health care, a right to education. Other societies take this as human rights. Americans are not willing to do that. So I would say that charge American human rights advocates to struggle just to get a feel of how difficult it is to transform attitudes within your own society. The death penalty is a good example. See those who have struggled to abolish the death penalty and how hard it has been to understand how difficult it is for others to do the same in their societies. But assuming that both sides of us are doing this, then we can engage in what I call cross-cultural dialogue to promote consensus. So it is not that I'm assuming that Muslim societies will come to the table just fully closed with their own convictions and no change. But no, they are sort of, and they are. They are women's rights activists. They are freedom of religion activists who are struggling in those societies. Now, about imperialism, if I may close with this point, is that imperialism makes it very difficult for human rights advocates to struggle for the rule of law in international relations and struggle for human rights in their societies. That, for me as a Muslim, I would say, I should not, the United States behavior should not be my standard, so that I should be committed to these values regardless of what the West does or does not do. But the reality is that many people in my communities will say, why should we abide by these standards if the United States is not willing to abide by them? So that double standard issue, therefore when I say that imperial impulse of the United States, like invading Iraq or engaging in sort of all sort of imperial ventures, that undermines the very possibility of international law. I want to challenge jihad, Muslim sort of understanding of aggressive jihad, as contrary to the rule of law and contrary to civilized behavior. But it's very difficult to do that when people feel under attack by a superpower that appropriate the right to act unilaterally, arbitrarily, outside international institutions, and expect others to abide by those institutions.
The short-term problem seems to be power and the abuse of power. The long-term solution is people changing themselves and changing their world. Briefly, one last question. Time is just about up for a brief answer. How would you advise students to prepare for navigating this? You, in our discussion, you have described what chasing the flame and keeping the flame alive was for you because of your parents and also because of your mentor, Taba. What advice for students?
Keep it personal. I think so long as when we think that we are solving the world's problems but not our own, I think we are missing the point. Only for me, what message I would like to bring is keep it personal, keep it immediate. Because I tend to avoid responsibility if I can. I tend to evade questions if I can. So keep my feet to the fire. Understand that I have a very limited span of life in which I am supposed to heal my inner self into one being, so that when I depart whole and not divided. I don't have time to waste. And I would say for everybody, find your cause, find your issue, but keep it personal and give it the best you can.
Abdullah, thank you. That was very a great discussion. Let me show your book one more time. And I want to thank you for coming to the Berkeley campus and being on our program.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Thank you. And thank you very much for joining us for this Conversation with History.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.